underlying principles of the sequence of, maybe this morning, one of the underlying principles of the sequence of loving kindness practice is doing things in the easiest way possible. And that's why you are instructed to start with yourself, because that's the presumption that that's easiest, and you slowly make your way over the course of time to the difficult person or the enemy who's that much more difficult than, certainly than, say, the benefactor, somebody like that. And that's why even when we get to the difficult person, the suggestion is that it would not be such an unthinkably difficult person right away. But I've also found, just as an aside, that most people don't like that suggestion. We seem to like to go to the edge pretty quickly, and I've given that instruction a whole lot of times where, at the end of which sitting, you know, someone will raise their hand and say, well, I tried sending loving kindness to Hitler and it didn't really work. And I think, well, didn't I just say, like, maybe don't start there, you know? But we seem to like to go there. And remember, it's not that, I mean, that's a big question. How do you do that? And so partly what we're doing along the way is getting a deeper and deeper understanding of loving kindness as strength, as a manifestation of wisdom, not as being stupid, not as giving in. And, you know, the balance between loving kindness for ourselves and others, and what does it mean when, you know, you may be coming from a compassionate motive and you take very strong action to try to stop someone's behavior, you know. And so even if we're not intellectually wrestling with all of those questions, that's what we're actually doing experientially as we keep building on the loving kindness. And so, it's a very powerful place to come to. Now, when I was in Burma, which is the first place, as I said, that I did this practice systematically, intensively under guidance, I was there for a long time, for 3 months. So the first 3 weeks were just loving kindness for myself and a benefactor. And it took 6 weeks to get to the place where we just got to. So, especially in that first 3 weeks, my benefactor was one of my teachers, this woman named Deepa Ma, whom I love very, very much. And so, there was nothing easier than to sit and offer her loving kindness. And the whole time, pretty well, those 3 weeks, I kept thinking, I'm cheating. You know, I'm doing something that's too easy to do. This isn't going to count until I'm face to face with my most difficult person in life and struggling and sweating and crying. I said something like that to Upandita, kind of like, when am I going to get to, especially because I knew that was out there, you know, in the sequence. And he looked at me, as he often did, and he laughed. And he basically said, why do you want to do things in the hardest way possible? They're meant to be done in the easiest way possible. And this is a theme that keeps occurring, that we're building in some ways a platform of joy, of confidence, of clarity, of delight. And the whole path is like that. And that's sometimes very hard for us, because we equate struggle, you know, terrible struggle with progress. And it's not that we can't make progress when we're in a terrible struggle, but there's something about the teaching, which is also about, it's like building capacity all along the way, which is why they say when the Buddha was talking to lay people, to householders, he always started with a teaching about generosity. Because, as he put it, everyone has something to give. It may not be material. It may be a smile. It may be paying attention to somebody. It may be continuing a conversation with them when they sort of seem at loose ends, like maybe they have no one else to talk to, or, you know, giving of our energy, or giving what we can materially, whatever it might be. Everyone has something to give, and the giving brings us joy. It brings us, these days we call it self-respect. It brings us into that state of feeling we have something to give. And based on that, we practice morality, which from the Buddhist point of view is also a practice of joy, and it's a practice of generosity. It's giving the gift of fearlessness so that people know we're not going to exaggerate or, you know, shade the truth, that we are going to speak directly, or that we're going to not cheat in, you know, some situation or whatever it might be, that we're allowing a field of trust and trustworthiness to grow around us. And it's also a creation or a platform for an awful lot of joy and happiness. I mean, really, when I came back in through the border the other day, it's always like a funny situation because, you know, I didn't have like and the people behind me on the airplane had an apple, an illicit apple they wanted to bring back into the country. And the flight attendant was saying, no, apples are the worst, you know. I mean, the worst of that kind. Contraband, you know. And it's like, don't even think about bringing in the apple. And, you know, and I was like coming back in and I thought, it's very different than when you're trying to sneak in that apple, isn't it? Right? There's so much more peace and spaciousness when you're not always worried, you know, like, what lie did I tell to who, and how do I reinforce it, and how do I bolster it, and what, you know, what if I don't tell that person to also lie? And, you know, that's a kind of big, complicated mess. It's just, it's actually a much more empowered and happy existence when you just think, coming back into the country, you know, it's all okay. And so we honor that as a place of happiness, and we feel the joy of that. You know, it's not being repressive, and it's not being moralistic, and it's not being self-righteous. It's really about our capacity for happiness, and on the basis of that, we are able to meditate so much more easily. I mean, it's hard enough, really, given everything. But if you're also sitting and you're thinking, you know, what lie did I tell and how do I get out of it and how do I do that, you know, it's very, very hard to get any peace of mind or any tranquility. And so it's all like this movement through greater and greater happiness and joy, so that by the time we are looking directly at whatever suffering or difficulties we face, it's not from a place of feeling already undone and confused and lacking self-respect and, you know, agitated and anxious. And it's from a different place because we've really built that capacity. And so it's a very similar thing in the loving kindness practice. It's not cheating. It's not because you're a coward, you know, it's not because you're afraid of looking deeply at suffering, your own. It's not because you're trying to avoid this really terrible enmity that exists between you and someone else, that you're not diving right in there. You know, it's building that strength. And even once there, it's perfectly fine to go back to doing loving kindness for yourself and just kind of move with that fluidity or flexibility. It's also true that, I think I talked about this a little bit before, that probably with every meditation practice, but definitely with my experience and my experience observing people in loving kindness practice, you will see the fruits of it, not perhaps so much when you are sitting formally, but you will see it in life, in relationship, you know, both to yourself and to others. And so, for example, I had a friend who came to Barrie and did an intensive retreat in loving kindness, and his difficult person was his former business partner. And he didn't feel any great resolution or whatever in the course of the retreat. And then he went back home, and there were some further meetings arranged because there had been a very acrimonious breakup of the of the business, and so there were some other meetings that had already been arranged. And he said that his former business partner walked into the room, and my friend looked up at him and said, "Hi, how are you?" And the guy looked at him and said, "Is that you?" That had been like the first human exchange they'd had in a very long time. Or we see we are different ourselves. We can't count on someone else's behavior changing, but we can change ourselves. And so things can be very different. We see that they are different. Because we have a very different sense of where strength is, where happiness is, what we actually want as we go on. And the fact that we can't count on how someone might change or might not change also brings us to the question of equanimity. If we go back to the example I was using yesterday, if you have a very beautiful and generous motive and you want to give someone this gorgeous vase of flowers, and you're very sensitive, you're very aware, you're really mindful of the context, you've kind of thought, this is how I might do it, that's most appropriate, that's most skillful. And you do that, and maybe the person that you offer the flowers to sort of nods distantly and walks away. So what's just happened? We've done something from the best motive that we can with as graceful and appropriate an execution as we can in that moment. And we didn't get the reaction we wanted. We didn't get the response we wanted. Sometimes we do, of course, and sometimes we don't. When we don't, it's very rare to consider, well, maybe they're having a bad day. Maybe they check their messages. And they're having a great day. They just found out they won $10 million in the lottery. They're going to buy every florist in, you know, Seattle. They couldn't care less about this vase of flowers. Because every moment, remember, is so many conditions coming together. You can't really say to somebody, something's going to happen at 10 o'clock. Please don't check your cell phone messages. Don't check your email messages. Don't have a conversation with anybody. And don't think a single thought before you come into the room. Something's going to happen. I want you to arrive as a completely blank slate. It's not ever like that. That's just not the nature of life. And so when the Buddha talked about the nature of life, he talked about what he called the vicissitudes of pleasure and pain, gain and loss, praise and blame, fame and disrepute. It's pleasure and pain, gain and loss, praise and blame, fame and disrepute. And it's the very nature of everyone's life. Not always in equal amounts by any means, but there's no one who experiences only pleasure and no pain. And there's no one who experiences only praise and no blame. The very same action that we do from whatever motivated us, with whatever skill we could bring forth, will sometimes bring praise and sometimes bring blame. Remember Auden saying, art has enough enemies. Right? So we need to explore what equanimity actually means. It shouldn't mean indifference, apathy, not caring, pretending not to care, coldness, withdrawal, removal. But rather, it actually means, you know, as we've been saying, perspective, spaciousness, the kind that's born from wisdom, that says there's always blame in this world. It doesn't mean we don't care. It doesn't mean we have no preferences. It doesn't mean we don't notice. And it doesn't mean that there isn't, say, a kind of sting when we don't get praise, when we don't get thanked. But we're not devastated. by that. Because either there's something to learn about our execution, or we need to let go with the understanding, with the very real wisdom, that we cannot control everybody's mind, their circumstance, how they will respond. It's just not that way. You know, somebody, we offer them the vase of flowers, they nod distantly and walk away. Usually we go into a rant. I'm such an idiot, I always give the wrong thing. Why this color flower? It was the wrong color. They should have been red. How could I not have known? You know, I'm always so bad at this. Right? So we take it in. We take it so to heart. And it is so devastating often, when actually we just cannot make it so that everyone always will just be delighted at our gift. And certainly not right away, which goes back to another element of equanimity. We may not know right away. We see what's in front of us. And it might be that this offering or whatever it is that we did, maybe it's going to ripple out later for this very person even, but not right now, in some way that we just can't control. So we feel our way into the state of equanimity, the balance that's born from wisdom, not coldness, not a lack of caring, but it's like a relief. It's the spaciousness we experience when we realize what we don't know, that we don't know how things will unfold from here. When we realize we're not in control. I'm not saying this is easy, but it's a very profound acceptance, which also opens the door for greater love and compassion. It opens the door for love and compassion in a more sustained way, so we can go through all the ups and downs. It opens the door for love and compassion as we are able to be present for someone when we realize we cannot control things. So the example that's often used in the Buddhist texts is an adult, a parent, whose child is now an adult, where it's not like you throw the kid out and you say, you know, you're grown up now, forget it. But there's love, there's tremendous connection, there's bonding, there's compassion, and there's a recognition, I can't make this person's decisions for them. I can't make them behave in a certain way. And so at the same time, there's all of that caring. There is also a recognition, that's the truth of things. That's the nature of things. And that understanding actually enables one to be there in love more than if we're simply fretting and filled with frustration. And that being there sometimes is more consequential than the actual efforts, right, to have an impact in some way. So this too is like a big exploration. What's the role of equanimity in actually hanging in there in some situation, hanging in the good way, you know, not like endlessly to no avail, but being present, offering that sense of presence, of caring, without there being so much expectation and demand, which will only diminish our ability. You know, look at the way, go back to praise and blame for a moment, because it is my favorite. We so rarely look at our motivation and the skillfulness of an action as the measure of our integrity, how well we've done, you know, what that action was really about. We're usually so locked into the immediate result that we are lost, because there'll always be praise and blame, right? And so we need to recall that there's always praise and blame, and go back to looking at our motivation and the skillfulness, the relative skillfulness of our action in terms of trying to get a sense of how well we've done. Rather than being so completely tied into this notion of praise and blame, it will always be there. Always, always. And it's not that we don't care, which I think would be, you know, kind of silly to pretend. I mean, of course we care. But to imagine that, oh, if I'd written a better book, every single person on the earth would have loved it. Not that likely. Right? It's just how it is. And, you know, everyone has, because it's so real to life, each of us has instances in our life where that exact thing happened, you know. You put your heart into something, did the best you could. Some people praised you and other people said, eh. You think, huh. But it is in the nature of things. The story I usually tell is about when my first book, Loving Kindness, came out. And I was in California soon after it came out. And I had lunch with somebody, and she said, oh, Sharon, you wrote that book in such a way. It's just like being with you. It's like sitting down and having a conversation with you. And I was so thrilled. I mean, it took me forever to write the book. And, you know, it was such a meaningful thing, and it was such an extraordinary compliment. I thought, well, you couldn't really say anything nicer to a writer. That's so amazing. And I was so excited about what she'd said that I was at dinner that night with a whole other group of people, and I brought up the comment, and someone at the dinner table said, well, that's not true. She said, I'm reading the book. It doesn't sound anything like you. It's nothing like being with you. And I thought, okay, you can be ecstatic at lunch and depressed at dinner, or you can remember they're talking about the same book, right? Written from whatever motive was sparking it, and with whatever level of skill I could bring forth into the effort at the time, it's the same book. Some people took it one way, and other people took it another way, and again, I would never want to imply I didn't notice the difference or that I didn't care. But the question is, how much do we care? You know, are we defined over and over and over again in our efforts and our actions by the praise and blame of others? Because if we are, we're lost. It just will not be that everyone, all the time, you know, so looking for ourselves as a reflection of others' views is very tricky because it's always changing. And we get very little satisfaction. Just recently I was in Washington, D.C. I've been teaching in somewhere in New York State, and there was this event, this very fun event called Buddha Fest, which is movies. It's like a film festival with talks and all kinds of things. So I was going to speak Saturday morning, but I wanted to hear, it was actually Congressman Tim Ryan speak Friday night. He's a congressman from Ohio who's written a book called Mindful Nation about his mindfulness practice and the ways he thinks it can be beneficial for education and the military and all kinds of things. So it's really a very nice book. And I know him, I've met him, so I thought, oh, I want to be there in time to hear Tim speak. So somebody actually gave me a ride from this place I was in New York down to Washington, D.C., and I got there a bit early for his talk. And so I went into the auditorium with a friend, and we were sitting. It was like in the second row of the theater, because it was a theater because of the films. But just in front of us, there was no first row. You know, it's sort of like an exit row in the airplane where you just stretch out. So there was like a gap, in front of us. And we were just sitting there waiting because we were pretty early in. I noticed somebody walking around with a copy of my book, Faith, which has a pretty distinctive salmon color cover. And I said to my friend, oh, look, you know, she's walking around with Faith. And then she saw me and she came over to me and she came in front of me because, you know, there was this gap. And she said, would you sign my book? And I said, oh, and I'd love to sign your book. And she said to me, you're a goddess. You're just a goddess. And I thought, that's nice. You know, that's a very nice thing to hear after this 5-hour drive, you know. So I was sitting there and then, you know, she left and was sitting with my friend and then, Tim Ryan's communications director, whom I'd also met, came over to me with a reporter who was going to write an article on his talk. And I would say about the reporter that I have rarely met anybody less interested in meeting me. And, even just in a kind of normal way, you know, like, so she introduced me. She said, oh, this is Sharon Salzberg. And he looked totally disinterested. And she said, do you know who she is? And he said, nah. Kind of like that. So my friend whispered to me, tell him you're a goddess. So I was like, I don't think so. You know, so that was about 1 minute. It wasn't even like lunch and dinner, right? Very close in time. It's like that. So when we say we meet it with equanimity, it doesn't mean indifference. It could mean humor, actually. This is pretty funny. It doesn't mean indifference, but it's wisdom. It's like we know. There's going to be all these ups and downs. People are going to take what we do and what we try in one way or another. It's kind of in the nature of things. So the more aligned we are with the truth, the better it will be for us and for everyone else. So equanimity is sometimes described as spaciousness. It's spacious stillness. It's perspective that doesn't make us give up. It gives us a different basis for which to continue on instead of being so caught in like success and failure, success and failure, success and failure. And in those ways, it's like everything gets more spacious and we have more energy to keep going. So we reflect. There's pleasure and pain in this world. There's praise and blame. There's gain and loss. There's fame and disrepute. We go up, we go down. We're not in control. So all these different aspects of wisdom. You know, you have a good friend and you have a really good idea of what would make them happier. Not just like being nosy or imposing your view, but a really good idea. And maybe you impart it and maybe you try and you cannot make it so. You just can't get them to do what you, pretty good idea, will make them happier. That's also the nature of things. And it doesn't mean you don't try. It means, actually, usually it means you can try in a different way. And you can try in a more sustained way than when it's... I think one of the most difficult feelings for us in general, one of the most difficult feelings for us to tolerate, to bear, is that feeling of powerlessness, of helplessness, and many times in a situation of some difficulty, that's what will have us turn away more than most things. And yet if we have wisdom, we understand that not being in control doesn't mean there's nothing we can do. And that our feeling of helplessness or powerlessness doesn't need to rule the day. That's not the most compelling thing going on in this situation. The other person's state is the most compelling thing going on in this situation. And that we don't know. We don't know how things will evolve over time. And that we can just do what we can do right now. It's all of that part of it. It's like having a big picture awareness. Not that we know, but that we can open way beyond the confines of of the moment. So there's pleasure and pain and gain and loss, praise and blame, fame and disrepute. How are we with all of that? And can we use our understanding to create a space of some peace within, so that, which is the equanimity, so that we can actually utilize that to reinforce and strengthen qualities like loving kindness and compassion and sympathetic joy. And that's why we talk about equanimity also as being at the core of mindfulness. Mindfulness isn't just knowing you're hearing a sound or knowing there's a certain emotion going on. It's knowing in a particular way. And that particular way involves not clinging, not condemning, not spacing out and delusion. So that's what equanimity means. It's balance. That's what equanimity means in that context. It's balance. It's out of that balance that the learning comes. Because if something comes up in our experience and we're fighting it and struggling against it and trying to push it away, there's not going to be a lot of learning. If something comes up in our experience and it overwhelms us and we have no space from it, there's not going to be a lot of learning. So that place in the middle, which we call mindfulness, doesn't mean we're disengaged. It means we're not attached, we're not condemning, and we can take a look in a very different way. That will lead to wisdom. Wisdom leads to more equanimity, which is the way equanimity manifests in terms of the quality of ours. Because the wisdom of seeing how things actually are is what gives us perspective. It's what allows you, you know, going back to my original example, is a very elderly person sitting in the playground watching children play. It's what allows you to care tremendously for that child who's freaking out and also know shovels break, right? That's how things are. It's not aberrant. It's life. And so as we address the child, it's without ourselves being stricken, falling on the ground sobbing, because we have that bigger perspective. So really we work with all of these qualities of loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity all of the time and all at once. So I'm going to suggest we go out for one last walking period, and then we come back and we'll do a sitting, and we'll just have to